Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhn. My today's guest has been an active UX practitioner in the San Francisco Bay Area for the last 20 years. He helps run the consultancy Gage and is a professor in data literacy and visualization in the Design Strategy MBA program at his alma mater, California College of the Arts. In this episode, we dive deeper into the changing role of UX as a profession. The area of responsibility for UX professionals is becoming larger and larger and also more differentiated. It is only possible to a limited extent to handle all tasks, starting with UX research, UX design, UX writing, accessibility, UX management, all alone in good quality. Specialization and professionalization in UX sub-areas will continue to progress and require continuous learning from UX professionals. On the other hand, due to the economic situation, the expansion of UX resources is stagnating or even declining in many companies. UX professionals will have to focus the use of UX resources, personnel and budget, on the most relevant and effective topics. In many companies, the question will arise as to how better results can be achieved with the same or fewer UX resources. It goes without saying that these changes pose completely new challenges for UX managers as well. It also means that traditional management topics and UX continue to grow together, whereas at the same time, UX professionals need to align their work more closely with the strategic goals of the company. In the end, UX professionals are and also will be people, and therefore ensure that there's always a human in the loop.
We thank our sponsor, Codeword Customer Consulting GmbH, your coaching partner in the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership. Are you a UX professional seeking to level up your career? Then let's get in touch for one-on-one mentoring or individual CV and portfolio reviews. Find our contact details in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you today.
Indeed, as places are limited, drop me a line at thomas@codewordcustomer.de or book an introductory call if you want to develop professionally, just have started a UX manager role and are looking for an independent sparring partner, or just want to chat with a seasoned UX leader about trends in our industry. But now, without further ado, let's start the show. Welcome to another episode of Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, your compass for navigating the ever-evolving landscape of UX maturity in organizations and UX team leadership. My guest today is Nick Hawthorne. He is based in San Francisco. He leads a small agency there, and he's a really seasoned expert in the field of UX, and I'm super happy to have you here on the show, Nick.
Thank you, Thomas.
Yeah, so first of all, I would like to ask you to give us a short self-introduction. So what's your background and where are you heading currently? And yeah, what motivates you to work in this field, basically?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I'll take you way back, Thomas. I remember as a young child, sitting down, we have a sort of Boy Scouts, sort of a young citizens organizations here in the United States. And one of the aftercare programs where we were all sitting down and drawing, with the thank you to the dead mothers who had patience for a dozen rambunctious youngsters, trying to keep them quiet by giving them activities. And I remember, 8 or 9 years old, looking at what I had drawn over the last 45 minutes and looking around at the table and seeing, wow, I really was able to focus on this and produce something that I was proud of. And the other kids were running around with their hair on fire and didn't have that same kind of connection to the visual artifact. And as I look back on my career, that was one of a couple different instances of affirmation that this was something I wanted to do and that I wanted to take time in. And there were a few others, coming into the university, I was a freshman. My very first day of university was in a visual arts class alongside of upperclassmen, juniors and seniors. And I remember that the first assignment, involved using a copy machine and creating storyboards with different symbols. And I remember just going all in on this project as a 18-year-old now, and feeling such pride in that output, and really, along the way, looking back at those projects or those deliverables, highlights of one's career. And they don't always have to happen in your adulthood. They can happen when you were a young kid, sort of milestones along the way. And that's always something I've carried with me. I was fortunate enough to have been raised in San Francisco, which had this nexus of technology and art. And I wonder what my career would have been if I hadn't had that movement coincide with my coming into adulthood in my early 20s around the year 2000, when this thing called the internet was coming into being. As I got some graduate education at my alma mater, California College of the Arts, and I say alma mater because I would go there for summer camps as a kid, and then wound up going there for a graduate degree. And now currently teach there in their MBA program. They offer something called design strategy. Was lucky enough to have that institution that was adapting to these changes within the industry. Graphic design, when we were using things like PageMaker and Quark Express around 2000, 2001, began to offer this track in design for new media. And new media was as much about Macromedia Director on CD-ROMs, delivering kiosk experiences or things you would install into your removable hard drive and use it on your computer, because the bandwidth that was creating this new world called the internet was still so constrained with dial-up modems that the interactivity was so much in its infancy. And Thomas, I realize I took you way back, and I'm bringing you to the present step by step, but we're almost there. And so interaction design became this offshoot of graphic design. And being fortunate and privileged enough to have early access to technology and Apple computers, again, happened to be in our backyard here in the San Francisco Bay Area, was always sort of confident with that use of tool, with that use of technology. And you'll follow that path down to where it is today. And that's using interaction and visual representation of code, much like the pen and pencil in the Boy Scout troop to the photocopy machine in that early college class. So I realize that was an extremely long answer to a short abstract question, but that's some of my history and my background of how I got to where I am today.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, this definitely brings us directly to the topic that we want to focus on today, which is the changing role of UX as a profession. I mean, you experienced it yourself in your long career, long-lasting career, how this field as a profession changes and how we as professionals also need to adapt. But maybe let us first talk about some highlights, maybe just recently that you had in your professional life or also in your early career. So, what were the highlights that you would point out besides what you've already mentioned?
I talked about going to art school. I have my children in art schools now, for better or for worse, as a parenting decision. And the wonderful thing about those kinds of projects is you can make them your own. When you're a student, your project is whatever you want it to be, and maybe the teacher will give you some padding and some guidance, but you do something that if you're going to spend a semester on, you really want to be done how you want to be and how you want to challenge yourself. And all of the highlights of my career have come when I've looked at a project, a client paying project, and said, how would I do this if I was in art school? What is it that I want to push myself to learn or to do that I haven't done before that will make this interesting? The joy and some of the extreme anxiety of being independent, running one's own agency, is that you get to make that up. The client comes to you and says, I've got this problem. I'm not going to tell you how to solve it. I can guess how you're going to solve it, but I'm really not sure. And you use that ambiguity as an excuse to really push yourself. And so all of those highlights have been from the quote we have here is being over one's skis, meaning you're going so fast down the mountain that you could tumble over the tips of your skis. But you know the analogy makes sense because skiing isn't fun unless you're just slightly out of control. And that's how I run my business. It's just slightly out of control. And so some examples are during the pandemic, there was a video game company, again, based here in the Bay Area, that was releasing a title. It was a skateboarding game, and it had to do with how avatars interacted within the game. There were some commerce aspects to it about branding and identity. And it was this beautiful mixed methods ethnography project that, in a time which the world was sort of shrinking and becoming closed and protected, we took to seven different countries around the world, designed multilingual surveys. To bring in the quant aspect, understandings of brand and valuations, as well as expression and subjectivity. And we're able to do this all during the pandemic. I mean, the only downside of it is I didn't get to go to Japan and to Brazil and to France and you know investigate these scenes. We visited skateboard parks and skate scenes, as well as retail outlets for skaters. That was something that came in a dream. It was really this beautiful, human-focused outreach project that lent itself into how do we make a user experience that comes from these inputs. So that was a highlight because going back to this term user experience, I really saw this come into being around 2008, 2009 when the iPhone came out because what was on the market were Blackberries, and really for phones that didn't have that same understanding that Apple did of what can you do to just make this work. That was one of the things that people pointed to Apple products and says, it just works. Well, no, it works because somebody was smart enough to ask the right questions and hide the fields you didn't need to see and understand the conditions and logics that you were likely to go down and make it feel intuitive and smooth. And up until then, it was just UI. And Thomas had a subjective way that Thomas wanted to make the UI, and Nick had his own visual language that Nick wanted to showcase. But when this notion of if you can apply a understanding of outreach and research and experience to make the fields and the interactions intuitive, then it provides a better experience for all. And shortly thereafter, there were these pattern libraries, Material Design, Project Kennedy for Google, Carbon or Cocoa. Those sort of design systems began to really trim the edges down of skeuomorphism or all of these subjective ways of we might interpret a UI in this manner. It's like those are going away, and standardization is starting to occur. And what's important is that you've got that flow down, not necessarily what color you make the button or what pattern is the background. It begins now. How do you get me through my task the most efficiently and with delight and pleasure?
Yes, so also for me, I think it's pretty important to understand that user experience is much more than the user interface. This is something which is mixed up quite often still. And what I usually show to my stakeholders to explain a bit better what user experience is a video by Don Norman, which I think was recorded exactly at that time, 2008, 2009 timeframe in San Francisco at a conference where he really explains how. When he was at Apple, how he came up with the term UX, and that it also is not just what you see on screen, it has also to do with the people using the product and their background. So yeah, this is the, it's a wide broader topic than people actually think who are not part of the field. Yeah.
Yep. And it doesn't have to be, quote, soft skills, which can be used as an insult, at times. Oh, this person has soft skills. They're used to talking with people and getting down on their level. There's very much a method to ethnography. a structure for which you collect qualitative data through in-depth interviews, through face-to-face. Another highlight was a research roadshow where we were helping a client bring a new product to market. And we did interviews in four or five different cities across the United States, and rented a bus and we drove from one to the other and went into people's homes. And I was fortunate enough to have taken a workshop at Emory University, and there was a graduate student there who specialized in qualitative research. And to watch her work of like this is not just open-ended conversations where much like this, we're sort of ranging around and bouncing off topics. To watch her moderate discussions repeatedly, several a day over the course of multiple days, the collection methods in which she used, and the tagging and understanding of the patterns that arise after this kind of data collection was stunning. I sort of dipped my toe into ethnography, mixed methods research, as UI became UX, and thought, well, I need to get in front of this informed based design decisions. And to watch a professional who had been doing this again for nonprofits, for government agencies, to make evidence based decisions at an organizational level, not just a button and widget based level, but to have that kind of confidence is that this sample size is a reflection of a greater scenario was again one of the highlights because UX does give you that visibility into these adjacent careers that another career path may not have chosen.
Yeah, and again or not again, still I think this also provides some challenges for us as people who are a bit more advanced in their careers and have teams to lead, and so we definitely also need certain competencies, which also changed while the UX as a profession changed. So as the focus of this podcast is also having a look and providing some insights for aspiring or already seasoned UX leaders, I wonder from your perspective, what makes a good UX leader and how can you use your experience as a UX leader in the field, and which competencies are most important from your point of view, which you need to bring to the table as a UX leader?
Thank you. That is a very humbling question. One of my contemporaries had this wonderful presentation where it was about designing your career, is to take those who you are leading and treat them as this art school project, or encourage them to have their own career as an art school project, where you're trying to understand your end goal. You're sort of having generative thought at the beginning to understand how we might do this, or mapping it out on a timeline. Here are the different touch points along the way. And this presentation is called Designing Your Career. It's the one project that you own completely. And so as we have UX leaders who are very familiar with designing client-based projects or internal projects or interaction projects, it's like, how can we take some of these same principles, the same structure and method and disciplines of which we look at going from thought to finish, and apply them to those who we work with? And what kind of accountability and checkpoints and leveling of skills need to take place when it comes to designing our own career? In my own history, the notion of what I thought success was has changed completely in the last couple of years. And that may be post-pandemic, that may be just getting older. But what I had thought that end goal was is now something that doesn't quite resemble 2 or 3 years ago. It becomes changes and difference. It's with the market, with the with the role of UX also changes, as well as the demand for different types of services. So going back to your question of what does it that the a good UX leader, adaptability and flexibility of the soccer goal may move. And where we're going right now may have to shift because, again, the market is shifting, the organizations are changing, and we're constantly adaptable. but also to understand is our muscle memory for how we design projects, and how can we apply that to one another's careers, and hold each other accountable for them.
So this includes also that I think trust is a pretty important topic for the teams you work with, because if you design your career, you're not quite sure where you're headed to, and you need to be able to try things out and maybe also, learn that some things won't work as intended. So yeah, it's important to create an atmosphere where this is actually possible, I think.
Trust and transparency. When you have to interpret guidelines or requirements and create visual artifacts that represent those, the person that's putting the work into that definition is trusting you to A, to listen, to be adaptable and responsive. I think trust plays a huge, huge role in what we do, because I'm always finding myself forcing adaptation of like, okay, this was my subjectivity. I thought it was going to be like this, but I'm hearing that I wasn't quite getting or understanding the feedback I was hearing. I need to make sure I adapt, and they can trust me to be flexible in what I do and where I go. So yeah, that it's I Thomas, I offer you empathy. It is a hard career to be a leader in when everybody's job title changes every 6 months. To say I'm going to put this stake in the ground and claim experience when that stake is being put into a molten lava, because it's something that eats itself so often with the advent of technology and the notion of here in the Bay Area and probably all around the world, when you have companies that only are on this planet for 18 months, that to say, well, this is what I do, this is how I do it, is not going to last long, because the company for which you do it in is not going to last long, odds are. And that shifting and adaptability is really hard to claim experience with. I have a contemporary, a coworker who had this wonderful phrase about balance. Balance is not standing in one place. Balance is taking small steps to the left and the right on the platform, because that platform is our career and our job, and it's constantly changing. So that understanding of I can relate these skills to this new environment because this environment is changing so rapidly. But these are the things I know. These are the callbacks and the foundation I can draw from.
So, are there, from your point of view, some basic generic skills that people should bring, or is it more that also people who want to start their own career in UX would need to be flexible? And also, I mean, we see also that no coding tools are more and more getting popular and stuff like that. And design patterns and repositories with design artifacts are being used, which was definitely not the case when we both started into the field. But are there some basic generic skill sets or competencies that would be needed, or that you look for maybe when you hire some staff for your agency?
I will talk about the staff of two children that I have hired over the last 13 years. I am just a reflection personal style. I tend to be very draconian. I know all of the be not all of them. I know some of the behavioral science hooks that technology in our lives have placed into us to take our attention, to take our money, to take our focus. And I am very protective of my son's interactions with technology. We have a biometric safe where the devices get locked into, so that that impulse at 11 o'clock at night when you can't sleep to go and pop open a screen doesn't get fulfilled. And there's a part of me that thinks that I'm holding them back. This is, again, going back to your question, I'm working up to the answer, so thank you for your patience. And by holding them back, I mean there are these hurdles that anybody who touches technology on a daily basis, like we do, has to figure out. How to rebase a Git repository, how to work within a version control system, how to manage your passwords, how to deal with hardware lag, how to learn new software. Like those are core competencies that I've been fortunate enough to have these barriers in front of me all along. There are some who haven't had that same kind of flexing of muscles to say, "Oh, I know what they're doing here. They're doing this and they're doing this, and that's how that works, and that's how that works." And these no-code solutions, oh, it's drawing upon these components, and I can override it like this, and then I can bring in this, and I can start to reference back patterns that I've seen in other software applications along the way. And I bring this up as a long-winded way of saying, that curiosity of how our tools are changing our output. I joked with you last time about how long in our conversation we'd go without saying the words AI. And I think we're about 17, 18 minutes in. So it's a new record for you and I, Thomas.
Yes.
Let's keep it going. But I think that's the latest shiny tool on our desk. And to instead of being dismissive or defensive, to be curious and to find where that application makes perfect sense. And depending if you're a UX researcher, it's understanding of qualitative data and how to summarize that, which generative tools are very good at. If we're a designer with a capital D, it's how to use these no-code solutions and start to standardize. If we work in policy, it's understanding what's happening with our data, who's using it, where it's getting sent to. I think that any of these are avenues for curiosity. And I hope that the flexibility that our careers bring, the power that we have standing in front of a room and presenting ideas, the trust that we have been lent from our coworkers as well as our clients, I hope that gives us a mandate to be curious and to be a thought leader about how these tools can improve our lives rather than being locked in a safe where dad doesn't let you get at them late at night.
Yeah, so the curiosity definitely. This is also something which motivates me to always think about new solutions. I'm quite some time in the automotive industry, and you could also think, okay, a car has four wheels, so what's the point? But there are a lot of digital services coming in, and yeah, you need to basically also understand some mechanical stuff in order to make this work. And also, the details of task differences while operating infotainment system versus an app that you can focus on and stuff like that. So, yeah, curiosity is definitely something I would also emphasize as a basic skill.
A car has four wheels, but it doesn't have a driver anymore.
Yes. You're more advanced in San Francisco than we are here, I guess.
It is the most mind-blowing thing, Thomas. Anytime I have a visitor, yourself included, if anybody's coming into San Francisco for Config in May, the Figma Design Conference, I will personally take you for a ride in a robo-taxi because as a user research study, it is fantastic. If you people react differently. Some don't want anything to do with it, and others are fascinated by it. And dream job, dream client is an ethnographer that specializes in autonomous vehicles of like, how do we build up trust here? And there are little micro touch points along the way that are already taking place. But to put a human being in a new environment like that, where they're not quite sure where the boundary lies, is really a fun sight to see.
Definitely, yes. So, coming back a bit more to, let's say, the changing role of UX professions and the role in organizations and stuff like that. So, recently, of course, we've seen that organizations are streamlining their design teams and looking for, people that they need and maybe others that, yeah, maybe were laid off then also. And How do you see the situation currently, and how does this affect also your work in your design agency? So what has led to this effect, and how can we also as leaders who are shaping organizations as well, how can we cope with this?
Yeah, there's consolidation happening, that's for sure. I was speaking to somebody who was laid off as the VP of research for Salesforce, you know, specializing in an AI products, storied career, great background, but was a victim of you know, the movements in society. And she is interviewing for head of product roles now, because she hears that the product leaders, as they're laid off and they're interviewing, they're getting asked, what experience do you have in research? What kind of research background? And as a product leader, that is a secondary skill at best, if not tertiary. And so to come at it from an angle of, you know, I am informing all of these requirements, I can help prioritize, I've got all of these streams of input, there's no reason I shouldn't be able to lead products as well. So that shifting or blending of roles and responsibilities is interesting. I would encourage people who are looking to make movements in their career to not just stay within the same UX label, to try to reach out into product, into design leadership, to really feel like these skills are transferable. You had a question earlier about, you know, what can we learn as leaders? What can we do? Product management is probably something that we don't quite put as a primary skill. The ability to manage Trello boards and tasks and tickets and assigning of hours and things like that, I mean, those lend itself to whatever job title that you might reach for. You know, that is sort of a reflection of, especially of our age. You can't see us on this podcast. I was told I have a face for podcasts, so maybe that's a good thing. But Thomas and I are both older or more mature in our careers. And, you know, that kind of attrition, especially when you work in the technology industry where it does trend younger, can be quite scary and intimidating. But the flexibility to, A, go outside of the technology industry into manufacturing or automotive or financial services, or to say, well, UX doesn't have to fit within this one vertical. It can be applied in multiple places. And the skills that we learn as UX professionals of research and practice and design can be also applied to product leadership positions. I think there's a nice overlap there.
Yeah, and coming back to the discussion about curiosity and also the no-code tools that are being used more often, would you still think that designers should learn to code, or is this something which is not necessary anymore these times?
They've asked that question for 20 years. They've asked that question. It's Adobe Photoshop 6.5, where you could create a raster-based image, and with the click of a button, you could export it to HTML. And if you ever looked at the code, it was tables inside of one pixel spacer GIFs inside of tables inside of the spaghetti code was atrocious. But it answered the question with a click of a button. I'm a designer. I made the screen look like I wanted it to, and now I've got HTML. So the answer is more complex now. I mean, the answer is even to engineers. Should engineers learn how to code? There's no code solutions. I just need to be able to type. I would say that designers need to learn how to prompt. And to learn how to prompt, you need to understand how JavaScript works, what kind of semantics, what is an ID in a class, what is a routing or an endpoint, or what's a prop, or these, you know, variables that go into the components we bring in. So whereas you may not be doing semicolon, colon, open bracket, close bracket, of which I've wasted so many hours of my career trying to figure out what was broken, you should understand, in order to get this end result, I need to construct prompts like this. I need to put my proper nouns in parentheses so that the algorithm doesn't think that it is a part of a instruction. It understands that it's a reference. I need to be able to speak first of where I want this change implemented. Is at an application level or as a page level? I need to use Markdown to be able to give hierarchy to my prompts so that the algorithm can say, first do this and then do these three things. I need to be able to talk about how to pass and move data from one part of the application to another. What's interesting is the componentization. We talked a little bit about design systems 15 years ago, how that really made things a lot simpler, because I think Apple and Google realized that standardization is good. If all of the apps on your phone look the same, they're a lot easier to use rather than every app by every developer looks completely different. I think we're going to reach a point now with agent-based interactions are going to start to really pick up, where we're not designing for users anymore, we're designing for agents. And if we are trying to make it so that the algorithm knows to click that button and knows to make that setting or do these things, it's like, what kind of patterns change when you reduce the level of interpretation from humans to algorithms? And I have no idea what I'm talking about at this point, other than we're seeing this rise of agent-based interactions. And that has all these implications, but I think it fits into component-based design systems and how, in order to more efficiently go through these algorithms, we've got to stick to the script of, matching and piecing together existing components rather than making new ones.
Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, this, I mean, if I would be a bit act as devil's advocate, so to speak, I maybe would say, okay, then the developers can do our job as well. I mean, what's the point hiring UX experts if the developers maybe have an even better understanding how to design for agents?
Yeah, or the product managers could do our jobs. How many times in your career where a coworker or a client has said, I'm not a designer, but let me show you these wireframes. Like, if you're good at this thing and I'm good at that thing, then we should both be doing the things that we're good at, not trying to cross over. And, I'm delivering a prototype to a client in a couple months, and it's using no code. I'm pulling in from their repository, building a prototype using their versions of React and Tailwind and Next.js, and running this through user testing, and then using their components of their repository and delivering back to the front end developers. Here's the quote comps. Here's the deliverable. And oh, by the way, it's using a front end code base that's based upon or branched off of your code base. And I hope I don't come across of, I'm not a developer, but here's the deliverable. I'm hoping I save you time rather than you having to code this all yourself. But I could be costing you time because of that spaghetti code, like Adobe 6.5 generates this horrible mishmash of JavaScript components. It's fast. It serves a purpose, and I'm trying to abide by where I see the client needing help.
Yeah, and I think what also is a special skill set that we as UX designers bring to the table is that we have some empathy, maybe for agents, but especially for the human beings using our products. Yeah. So I also think this might be an important topic to also document and make decisions, and yes, afterwards can tell why the heck we did something like we did it, and we can then justify in the end what the decision process was.
I mean, in 2010, the concept of designing for mobile was still in its infancy of like, people use websites on their phone from time to time. Yeah, that happens. It's 2G. It's the text readers. Like, yeah, it happens. Or accessibility for those who don't, to make sure that they're ADA compliant, American Disabilities Act. And so these sort of parallel design scenarios were always sort of on the fringes. They say that the future is already here, it just lives on the fringes. I think that this agent-based understanding of process and workflow is something that is presenting themselves on the fringes as a design scenario, of which, if you are adaptive and inclusive, it's hard to use the word inclusive as it refers to robots, but that you understand how this your artifact might be used to take into consideration that it may not be a human being using this. It may be an agent. And what those boundaries are or where they would get tripped up, I don't know. I feel like it's all just a giant captcha at this point.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, the concept of agents just being another persona that we designed for. I mean, something like that, maybe. Yeah.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
Yeah, and coming back to the topic of how we as UX leaders can cope with these changes. So we talked in the beginning also about what people should do when entering the UX field and how they should design their career as well. So what are your recommendations also for people coping with these changes and choosing to also maybe to take the next step in the career ladder? If we so I think I have quite some listeners who are thinking about taking the next step in their career to leadership or team leading role. So what would you recommend for them as criteria to decide whether or not they should take the step, or maybe also which company and career path would be best for them?
I'll try to give you the most humanist answer I can think of. And it comes from the experience of teaching of this graduate MBA program that I teach in is 30-year-olds, early 30s. This is 75, 80% of the students are in their early 30s. Every year at the beginning of class, I say, raise your hand if by the time you get out of this 2-year program, you are going to switch jobs or you want to switch jobs. Two-thirds, three-quarters, always raise your hand. They're using it as something for career change. And what you describe with UX leadership is like, I'm thinking about career change. And the answer I'm going to give you is not to go back to university. The answer I'm going to give you is to find people who are earlier on in their career and find something that you can work with them on, whether it be mentorship or teaching or collaboration. But the more you can expose yourself to people younger in the career that are making decisions that you've already made, the more it'll give you confidence of, ah, I've got to move like this, or I learned this at this stage in my career, and that will set me up for this. That kind of reflection or looking back at oneself is so helpful. It's the most gratifying, fulfilling thing I do all year is my time with these students. It's not because of compensation or anything like that. It just has to do with remembering who I was and where I was at that time and decisions that I made to get to where I am today, for better or for worse. And so I think that recommendation of, I'm a UX leader. I want to make these sort of decisions to go into product or to go into research or to stay where I am or switch industries. The more you can have these kinds of signals from those who have gone through the same process you have, the more it'll give you a attunement to your instinct of decisions you've already made in the past.
So yeah, sounds like also you would recommend to just do some user research in a sense, then and the mentees that you work with are basically the users of your leadership skills, and then just test and ask them what's good, what's bad, what you can improve and learn from that.
There's a coworker that is brilliant. He's paying vice presidents of products a compensation. He's got a recruiter that's reaching out, finding them, booking some time on the calendar, and he's using this as a research tool of how to position his agency. But he's also making these connections and these conversations and building up this trust along the way. It's this brilliant piece of new business, but it's showing curiosity and willing to have a conversation and empathy for what they do and how they would use outside agencies. It's not the cheapest method of generating new business, but I do see that wanting to get in front of people and hear yourself describe the dilemma you're going through really helps, you know, solidify or clarify what it is you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, great, great. Okay, so anything from your side which you would then recommend to our listeners? So can they find you online or get in contact with you if they have additional questions based on our conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. Our website is Gauge, that's GAUGE.io. We have two or three projects at a time. We often specialize in very technical solutions of cybersecurity, financial services, things like that. But you heard some more sort of qualitative or UX research-based projects that we do. There is a contact form on our website, but you're welcome to get in touch with me, nick@gauge.io. And if you want to talk about design education or design leadership or any of those things, or if you find yourself in San Francisco for the Figma conference, I promised you a ride in a robo-taxi, and I will make good on that promise. Google, you can get in touch with me for a discount code as I try to spread the word for these Waymos. But I've got, funny aside, Thomas, I've done this often enough that I've figured out you can program the taxi to have four different stops. So I've now developed a circuit of San Francisco's best sites. And, you know, like the big bus, which are ubiquitous around the world, when a tourist comes to town, oh, we go around the Coit Tower, we go out to the Golden Gate Bridge, we go up to Twin Peaks, we come back down to Fisherman's Wharf. Like, we see all these wonderful sites. And the thing about these robot taxis is that they drop you off, they'll go away, and then you say, oh, I want you to come back and pick me up. And there's not a grumpy or angry driver to say, where were you? Why were you, stepping out of the taxi and taking pictures? And like, you can program them to do your bidding. So again, that's how you can get in touch with me. You can find me in the back of a robot taxi all over Northern California. I will be the human being or your human in the loop.
Cool. Yeah, sounds really great. And yeah, of course, we will link have all those links in the show notes for everybody to make it easy to get in touch. And when I'm in San Francisco, we're going to ride on a robo-taxi.
No hands,
definitely. Yeah, thanks for your time, Nick. It was really great chatting with you. And thanks for your awesome insights.
Awesome. Thank you, Thomas. Yeah. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks. Bye.